fake it through the day with some help from Johnny Walker Red. Send the poison brain down the drain to put bad thoughts in my head.
This is Will Houck from KNBC, and we're talking with Larry Crane on the line. Thanks for joining us tonight, Larry.
Thank you.
I know you're a busy guy, and you got a lot of irons in the fire, but the main thing I've connected with you on is the magazine Tape Off, and I was wondering if you could tell us about the history of the magazine and how it got started.
Yeah, I mean, the history of the magazine is kind of a long story, but the basic gist of it would be that I had written for other kind of magazines in the past, like small zine type publications. And I'd been in a band, you know, for about 8 years and such before that, even other several bands making records and going to the studio. And so when right before Tape Op started, all the magazines I was writing for dried up and stopped happening. And I was starting to get really into home recording. I'd always been kind of into it, but I was getting really into it and trying to up my game a little. So I started asking a lot of questions, and it sort of led to printing up a magazine, you know, like, hey, I know, here's an outlet for writing, and here's an outlet also for me to, a way for me to learn a lot more about the music recording world.
Right. How much of the magazine came from that whole sort of DIY punk rock scene?
I mean, probably 100% initially. You know, I would look at other magazines that had big, huge recording consoles on the cover and huge rooms and you know, recording rooms. And I would think, I'm never going to make a record in a place like that, you know. And I, the band I had been in had worked in really sort of like, you know, lower budget places, I guess, if you want to call them that. They were great studios run by great people, but they weren't fancy, fancy studios. So I knew that world, and I didn't know the world of like you know, $1,200 a day budgets or anything like that, you know. So I, it just, for me, it was like a real super grassroots, super DIY, because all the bands I would do shows with and stuff like that were all making cheap records generally, you know.
So what got you into music? What was your connection to music early on?
I'm not really sure. I'd say that it was always kind of around, and that's the usual cliche people say. But, you know, my parents, my mom was really into music. She would be playing, you know, Bob Dylan and the Beatles and stuff, Joan Baez, and various music, Johnny Mathis as well. My family knew the drummer from Creedence Clearwater Revival, Doug Clifford, who actually used to live in Incline Village nearby you there. And they knew Doug for years, and so he would drop off albums every once in a while, and my mom had hung out with Roy Orbison when she was young. She dated one of the guys in his band when she was in high school, I think. And so there were all these funny connections that just seemed like the music world wasn't that far away, if that makes sense, you know? Well, I was just really drawn to music. I just really, you know, in my teenage years, I got really absorbed by things like Pink Floyd and a lot of other kind of spacey music, a lot of krautrock and things like that. I was actually able to hear, there was a great radio station in Nevada City called KVMR. And actually the two of the guys that were DJs there really turned me on to a lot of great music. And I went and got my my radio license. You had to actually have a radio license back then to be a DJ. And I got one in high school, and I used to sit in on radio shows and stuff. So it had a lot. I thought that was a great outlet for learning about music.
What instrument were you playing back then?
Well, I wouldn't call myself a musician at that point, but I was kind of just doing a lot of weird things. I made some electronic boxes in my high school electronics class that made funny noises, and I even used some primitive computers and programmed stuff in them to make beeping sounds, and a lot of Radio Shack stuff that I went and bought. So yeah, it was kind of more like just sort of experimental things, you know.
So, you know, over the years you've worked with so many amazing musicians. I was wondering if you had any big standout moments that you remember.
Man, I mean, certainly many. You don't work with someone like, you know, artists like Elliott Smith or Slater Kinney without thinking, wow, this is pretty good. You know, like you don't see a performance of someone of that caliber go down the studio and think, oh, that's okay. You know, you do know it's sort of special and it's going to speak to people. But honestly, one of my favorite, most memorable sessions certainly was the Go-Betweens did a record called The Friends of Rachel Worth. Called The Friends of Rachel Worth. And it was kind of their comeback record. And my friend Janet Weiss played drums on it. And I engineered it all. And it was just really amazing to work with a band who I owned all their records. I'd been thinking about the band for decades and enjoying their music and be able to hang out with them, meet them, and make little suggestions and help the record be better. It was just unreal, you know. That was something else.
That's cool. What about as far as the magazine goes, people you've interviewed or gotten to meet and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, Brian Eno was certainly one of my favorite. That was like my end goal. Like, okay, if I do that, I can close the magazine up and call it a day. And you know, that happened a number of years ago. So I guess we're still in business. But, you know, I really didn't think that would ever happen. And I wouldn't never get to meet someone like that. So that was really fantastic to me. Certainly, even other engineers and producers are like, wow, you got to hang out with Brian, you know, because they really respect him and he's really creative and interesting. But certainly, you know, Glenn Johns was amazing. T-Bone Burnett had just wonderful words of wisdom. I mean, so many people. It's kind of, yeah, I just did some interviews recently, one with Chad Blake, who always just has just fantastic ideas and enthusiasm for music. I think that's the thing is like when you interview someone who's been in it for 30 or 40 years and they still just go, you know, they're just excited about hearing good music and making great records. And you know that, okay, this is something I can also do for some stretch of time. You know, if I'm lucky.
Right. Yeah. That's one of the things one of the underlying things I get from all these producers and musicians that are in the magazine is that they always just kind of come back right to the music. You know, they don't want to talk about microphones and software and all, you know, studio setups and stuff. They want to talk about performances, yeah. You know, and I think that's such an interesting thing about the magazine.
Well, what would be the only constant if you've made records for, you know, 20, 30 years like I have even, you know, the only constant is songs and talent and music, you know, everything else has been in flux, you know. I mean, when I first started recording, you had to record on tape. There wasn't really any other option. And now you have this computer thing and it's like, so that changed, but it didn't make the music necessarily better. You know, it just changed, you know? And I think that anyone that really understands, you know, the science of recording knows that the tools are always going to be in transition to some degree. And there's classic things that people like to use, you know, in the studio, but, you know, and those work great too, but it's like, you have so many options available, you know, it's not like working on a car where, you know, you do have to have a thing to pull the tires off of the hub and those kind of things. And that doesn't change a whole lot over the years. It's like these things keep changing quite a bit around us and we have to work with that stuff and learn that stuff. But we also, you know, have to ignore it to a certain degree in order just to pursue the art of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great lead into my next question, actually. I was thinking about, I was just recently listening to the Brian Eno interview, and I had read it a while back, but I just subscribed to the podcast and was kind of re-listening to things. And in it, he talks about how in the 60s, multi-track recording kind of opened up this new world, and he saw it, and a bunch of other people saw it as similar to painting, that you could paint in layers and sort of add to it as you go. And then you kind of progress to our modern times, and now we have multi-track recording, and you know, where it's almost limitless. And guys like Jack White are going back to this sort of minimalist approach of trying to peel away that. And it sparked a lot of conversation amongst musicians and producers and everything. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts on music and multi-track and versus minimalism and just all that kind of stuff.
Oh boy. I mean, well, the first thing that always has to be said is, like, you know, there's just so many ways to create an awesome album or collection of music or song, record a song. There's so many ways to record a song. But having said that, you know, there's also so many ways to inundate yourself with choices and to overthink and overdo and overwrought an item in front of you. You know, like, you can do a 400 track song right now, and to mentally log that and keep track of that as a producer or a mix engineer is just mind numbing. And I've been in these 150 track song situations, you know, sometimes of my own devising along with whoever I'm collaborating with. But, you know, you have to compartmentalize bits of it and say, okay, that bit's done, I'm not going to touch it. And so these massive amount of tracks is not certainly not something that's going to go away. And, you know, I think the funny thing is the people that complain about them the most are the people that have never worked on sessions like that, to be honest. You know, I mean, I'm sure Jack White's never sat in and worked on a record with like 400 tracks because he doesn't want to, you know. And I don't blame him, you know. But when I work as a producer, I've done records recently where I tracked on 16-track analog tape, because the client thought that would be nice. And I said, sure, let's do it, you know. And several of those sessions last year were just really enjoyable, and they went really fast, especially at the end. We'd be mixing a song like every hour, just banging them out, because there wasn't a lot of stuff to sort through and make choices on, and you couldn't nudge a drum hit. And so, you know, it set up a certain limitation, you know, as far as like the goal of perfection or nailing it to exactly be what you wanted to present, but it also just gets it done, and then you go, well, that's what it is, that's the artifact, you know. So I get a little worried about people that try to lay down laws around it. And someone like Jack White would be a good example. He never tells anyone else how to make a record unless he's producing it. He doesn't go to Radiohead and say, you're using too many tracks, or somebody, I don't know, you know. He doesn't care. That's not his problem. He's talking about how he wants to make a record, you know. So I think that's a very important thing to understand. If a mix engineer or a tracking engineer producer says they don't want to deal with more than 24 tracks, then you know, hopefully they're in a position where that's an economic possibility, that they can get enough work. But, you know, I have to be careful. I get tracks from people's home studios that are 40, 50 tracks. And I just have to grin and bear it, even if it seems like it could have been done with quite a few less, you know, because I want to work. I want to stay busy.
That's a balance you have to maintain as a studio guy. I think that's a tough place for you to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's times where it's been really discouraging when someone brings in a song with like 100 tracks and it's really a simple, you know, guitar, bass, drums, vocal, backing vocal song. And they haven't sorted anything out. They're like, every little vocal idea is still in there. And they're like, well, I kind of like that. And I'm like, well, which vocal do you want happening right here? Because you've got 14 different ideas. Like, I don't even know. I don't know. I'm not your producer. I'm just trying to mix it with you, you know. And then you have to become more of a producer and really take the reins. And no one's, you know, hired you. And maybe in that capacity, or warned you, so to speak. So it's an interesting time. You know, I find myself being applying more of my personal taste and my production skills in the mixing process nowadays than I ever imagined I would, you know?
Right. Well, speaking of the music world in general, I was wondering, what are some positive trends you see in the music industry recently?
Man, you know, that's a good thing. There's so many things. It's a good question. There's so many things to look at and say, this is good. I think one of the things that's really happening is that with a lot of the software that's out there, like Ableton Live is a really good example. It, if you buy that software and you got some rudimentary stuff, you can sit down and start creating music. And I think that we're seeing a lot of people that are coming to it, to writing songs and stuff in a different way. And I think we're seeing a lot of, I've met a lot of women that are drawn to working this way as a creative way to start building tracks. I just did an interview with a woman who goes under the name I Am Snow Angel, and we had this great discussion about how she works and produces people and creates and all this stuff. And I think that there's, because everyone's used to being around computers, there's less of this thing like the old boys club nastiness of you know, the big tape decks with the big reels and the studio console and, you know, some kind of jerk sitting there going, "Hey, Missy, don't touch this. You don't know how it works," you know? And I think we're seeing some doors opening up. And I'm also, see that as like, you know, every computer has, you can probably get, like you mentioned Reaper earlier before we started, you know, Reaper's a very affordable piece of software that anyone with a computer can basically have and make recordings on. So anyone that's like at an economic disadvantage, all they need to do is find an old computer somewhere and start running it, and they can make recordings. Whereas the gatekeepers of the fancy studios back in the day, when, you know, the only way you could make a record properly, I'm putting quotes on that, was that the 24 track reel to reel tape deck or such, you know, that's gone. And I think that that's a really great thing, to think that there's other voices that are going to find a way to get their voices across. You know, you saw that with hip hop in the past, you know, where you didn't need a full studio to build tracks. You know, you could use it with an Akai sampler and a microphone and a multi, you know, couple tracks of a multi-track, you could make an amazing hip hop record. So I think when those doors open up, you get creativity from areas that maybe weren't being, you know, safe in a financial place where they could make records, you know?
I just wanted to hear about your take on running a studio in our modern times with all these changes that have taken place.
Well, I mean, it is a kind of, I think I must be an amazingly clueless person to run a print magazine and a recording studio with analog tape decks in it at this day and age. But, you know, none of what I do is meant to be like a retro sort of a backwards looking sort of world. I'm not that type of person by any stretch. But what I do see, like at 22 years of owning a professional recording studio here, what I see is that people need, you know, it doesn't matter that we do have all this access to equipment. If someone's trying to do like more complex things, like record strings or record like, you know, six musicians at the same time and certain stuff like that, it's just not easy to do in a home or a rehearsal studio or any kind of cobbled together place. You know, the quietest room in your house is going to be louder than most studios, just the incidental noise of your home and noises that leak in. And I just think that that's something that people find, you know, that a recording space that you rent out or use, you know, utilize, can really be an advantage. So, you know, we do find that we have a lot of sessions that come in, track some of the stuff, like the multiple musicians at once, or get the drums done and then go take them home and work on the tracks. And that's awesome to be a service like that. And, you know, I end up mixing a lot of home recorded projects for people, you know, from all over the world. And that's super fun, you know, to just take the challenge of that and try to give them the best quality you can, you know, in the mix process. And I think it's, you know, one thing that works really well for me is having a very mid-priced studio. Like we're $350 a day right now for the space without an engineer. And that might seem like a little bit of money to someone that doesn't work in the field. But then again, if you went to a really nice hotel right now on an off day, you're going to spend $200 a night. So, you know, not even a really nice, a pretty nice one. So think about that as well. And, you know, we provide a service, and we never tell anyone they have to use our space, but obviously people do, and the place stays busy. And, you know, people like the choices of equipment we have, the sound of the rooms that we have, the console. and you know, the monitors are accurate. They can get work done, and they're not surprised when they take it and play it somewhere else. So those are all the things you can offer at a studio that are really hard to achieve in a home environment. You know, unless you're really throwing hundreds of thousands of dollars at it. You know,
right, right. So do you have any advice for a person who wants to get into the music industry in any capacity?
Oh, boy. You know, I didn't start making a living in the music world until I was about 33, making a full-time living. I worked in food service for a number of years. And so to me, you know, it wasn't something I sat down and said at 18, like, I'm going to be in the music business and I'm going to make music, make money making music or being involved in it in any way. I had no concept that that was something I could pull off. It seemed like a, you know, like a dream. So for me now to have been doing this for 20 plus years, I feel really lucky. You know, I'd say the main thing that got me through all of this is being a massive music fan, because at the end of the day, you're not always working, you know, as a studio engineer and such, you're not always working on music that's going to stand the test of time or be recognized for the value. Even if it is great music, it might not get recognized by anyone. So you have to be ready to help people make their music a lot better. And you also have to be ready to accept a sort of a failure of the music system to get that music in front of people. So being a fan, you know, I always can listen to stuff and hear the good parts of it, hear the things it reminds me of that I really like, and help accentuate the music in ways as a producer that maybe wasn't obvious to the people creating it, and bringing that to it's like the biggest thing. I can talk about all kinds of styles of music and artists all day with the people I work with, and I think that's really a big bonus, you know, because if all I knew was the engineering part, like the technical part of making a record, what would I be, you know, what would I be bringing to the session, like, you know, really anything, or just the ability to get a signal recorded, you know, which is at the end of the day not really that much,
right? And that seems to be a thing too. That's kind of a common thread in the magazine and just in general. I see people involved in the music industry are just huge fans of music, and it's almost like they can't not do something connected to music, you know?
I mean, yeah, think about that. Like, I, what else would I do at this point? You know, I'm a magazine editor, but a magazine about music recording. I'm a studio owner. I'm a producer, mix engineer. I educate people, but I only educate them really about music recording stuff. You know, it's my whole world. I feel really lucky that I kind of fell into something. I never thought I'd be doing engineering or anything as a professional. I think I fell into it by building all the skills around it and then realizing, oh, I could do this. And, I think anyone that wants to get into this business, they've got to start, you know, with just a pure, unadulterated love of music. And then they could bring that to it and carry through. They'll find if they love that and they love being around the people that are creating music and they have a great attitude for all this, then they can find a niche for themselves. But, you know, if I started this out at 18 saying I've got to get paid, I don't think I would have lasted very long. Or gone anywhere, you know. So I consider myself lucky that I make a living by doing two things I'm pretty into.
All right. Well, where can people find out more about your work on the internet? Where what are the different websites we can find you at?
Yeah, I got too many websites. The main one for obviously the magazine Tape Op has tapeop.com. It's TAPEOP. As it's in short for tape operator, which is where the name came from. But tapeop.com, jackpotrecording.com for my studio here in Portland, Oregon. And I even have like a personal website called Larry Crane, Larry-Crane.com, which kind of leads to like my LinkedIn learning videos and courses that I do there. And my mixing services and a lot of different stuff like that. So there's quite a bit available, you know.
Cool. What about social media? Do you do much on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook?
Oof. You know, I do a little bit on Twitter. I have one called El Crane Tape Op on Twitter, but that's about it. I do LinkedIn stuff a little bit, but mostly because of my courses on there. But honestly, like, I put so much back into the world. Social media seems like a distraction, you know, and maybe that'd be my bit of advice for someone that wants to get things done. I think some people can work it really well and do well at it. And I have people that run my social media from our studio and from my magazine. So I don't have to do those, except for this coming next few months. I'm going to have to run the Twitter account for Tape Op because our guy's on vacation. So that's going to be awful. Or it might be fun. Some of it'll be fun.
Yeah, I had to get away from Twitter. It was too much fighting, and I was like, man, this is just so negative. It's crazy out there.
Yeah, I don't understand that part of the internet. I think that seems kind of strange that you're given this huge forum, and if people really want to argue, they should have places they can go to just to argue with each other and not just put that everywhere else, you know.
Yeah.
Arguing corner over here.
So what's on the horizon for the upcoming year for you? Do you have any big projects you're excited about?
There might be a kind of a special Tape Op book coming out by the end of the year, which will be pretty interesting. And keep an eye out for that. I've got a lot of sessions. I'm doing a band called Moon Duo coming up, which is one of the people in that band is from the Wooden Ships. They're a really cool psychedelic band. And I've got a lot of mixing sessions and different things. And I'm going to go to Miami to a music expo event there in Miami. That sounds really cool. And I'll be at Summer NAMM in Nashville in, I think, July or June. And I'll be in New York for the AES conference in October. So I travel a lot, too, for the magazine stuff. And I do interviews. And so that part, I just love going places. You know, it's really exciting for me to, I think, like you said, like to go eat the food in different areas and go see the music. It's pretty special.
Yeah, for sure. All right, man. Well, that's pretty much all I got for you as far as questions go.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, man.